Thank you so much, and thanks for the opportunity to speak, although it came in a short notice, so this is a very spontaneously created seminar. So I want to tell you a few words about the approach to effective quantum gravity and cosmology, which I'm working on with my collaborators, Klaus Feenhagen, Romeo Brunetti, and Nicola Pinamonti. And first, maybe just a few words of motivation. So I come from the algebraic quantum field theory background. So I want to explain some things which are probably not obvious to you, but I will be using them later on. So which part maybe I should start here, because that's very far away. I don't know which. Let's see. Is it good if I start here?
It's right there.
Okay, but this and smaller over here, I see. I'll try to reach a compromise. So first, algebraic quantum field theory, where this whole approach started. So the idea goes back to Haag and Kassler. Sorry? Oops, oh wow. Oh wow. One should be enough. Right, so they had an axiomatic framework to describe quantum field theory on Minkowski spacetime. So let's say we have M, which is the Minkowski spacetime, so R4 with the standard metric, which I choose with this signature. And we have some bounded regions of that. And idea is that we define a theory by specifying the algebras of observables that can be measured in these bounded regions. So we take a region O and assign to it A of O, which is the algebra of observables. Okay, and the basic physical idea is that if we go to a larger region, we don't lose observables, so we get more to measure. So the first axiom, if you want, is that if I have O1 in O2, then I also have an embedding of algebras, A of O2. So that's the isotony axiom. Okay, and now there are some further requirements. So I want to have some sort of causality, so like Einstein's idea that nothing travels faster than light. So causality. So if I have two regions which are causally separated, so this notation means space-like. Space-like regions, then I expect that measurements in one are independent of the measurements in the other. So then, well, the algebraic way of saying it is that the corresponding observables commute. So A, B, so that's a bit of quantum mechanics, is zero for all A in A of O1. And B in, A of O2. Okay, so that's the causality. And there is a third one, which is some sort of like initial value problem in quantum theory. So it's called the time slice axiom. Okay, so what it says is that if I have a Cauchy surface, so I have sigma in M, and take some neighborhood N, it's a neighborhood of sigma, and I look at the algebra of observables in this neighborhood, this should give me the full information about all the observables in the whole spacetime. Okay, so maybe before I get to that, come back to that story, so I define the local observables here, and I also need to say, well, what would be the global algebra of all the observables? And this is defined. Yeah? Sorry? Yes.
Yeah, is it to satisfy the axioms if all the operators commute? You only said they actually commute if there's space
separated. Yeah. If everybody commutes, that's a very boring algebra. I mean,
so is there an axiom against P4?
No, there is no axiom, but okay, well, you can have models which are trivial, right? I mean, this would be just the identity, probably. I mean, if this is just, if everything commutes, it's just multiples of identity. So all your observables are multiples of identity. So yeah, I mean, this satisfies the axioms, okay? I mean, that's great, but that's not really interesting for physics, I guess. Although there is no contradiction.
What I'm really asking, your physical theories are gonna have definite, not just non-commutation, but definite non-commutation associated with canonical commutation relations.
Yeah.
Time evolution, so forth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is it enough to just have the axioms you have, or how do you limit yourself to theories which are actually real quantum field?
Okay, so this is just a framework, and you can, if you're looking at a concrete model, then you put more requirements. Like, if you have some concrete theory in mind, then usually you start with Lagrangian, and that already tells you something. And then from the Lagrangian, you get the field equation. From the field equations, you get propagators. So this is, well, this is at the later stage. So at the moment, I'm not specifying a concrete model yet. So this is just an overview of the approach, and then I will go to the concrete model of perturbative quantum gravity, where it's more specific. Okay, just one thing I wanted to define was the global algebra, which is sort of a certain limit. So I take the algebras larger and larger, and for anyone who is familiar with these things, this is an inductive limit of algebras. So I take the inductive limit, I obtain the global algebra. And here, coming back to the story with the Cauchy surface, so if I have a neighborhood of sigma, then the algebra of that neighborhood should be isomorphic to the global algebra. So I had a relation between the local data specified in the time slice and a global object I get. It's an inductive limit of algebras. Okay, so that's enough about the Haag-Kassler. Now, what I would be interested here in is a generalization of that. So the next step is the locally covariant quantum field theory. So this is the generalization of Haag-Kassler to curved spacetime. So here, okay, I was on Minkowski. Now I want to go farther. So I take Mn. These are some globally hyperbolic spacetimes. Everybody knows what's a globally hyperbolic. Should I explain it? Okay. Who wants me to explain it? Yay, I like my students. I will explain it. So globally hyperbolic, it means has a Cauchy surface. So in particular, M can be written as the Cauchy surface cross R. Okay, so this is globally hyperbolic. Now, I also want things like oriented and time-oriented. All right, and now I want to put some restrictions on possible embeddings. So here I had just subregions of fixed spacetime, and now I want to go bit more general, but still keep some sort of control on what embeddings are sensible. So admissible embeddings chi from M to N. Well, I want them to preserve all the structure, so they should be isometries. They should be orientations preserving. And the second one, I don't want to create new causal links after embedding something. So let's call it causality preserving. So instead of explaining it, I think it's best way to give an example of something which is not causality preserving. So assume that I have a diamond O and embed it into a spacetime, which is a cylinder, so circle times R. And well, I could embed it just by putting this around the cylinder. Now the problem is, if my spacetime is embedded in such a way that, so if this diamond is embedded in such a way that these two points meet behind the cylinder, so if I wrap it around, then these are initially causality non-related, but if I wrap it around, then I would create a causal link between them. So this is not admissible. It's a sort of pathological situation I want to avoid. Okay, so that's all. And now I want to define my theory, which assigns to all globally hyperbolic spacetimes some algebras, and to all admissible embeddings some maps of algebras. So a locally covariant quantum field theory is assignment so M goes to A of M, and admissible embedding A of, sorry, M to M would go to alpha chi, which is now a map from A of M to A of N. Okay, and I require some natural properties, so for example, the covariance. So covariance means that if I have chi1 composed with chi2, so if I have two embeddings consecutive, and I take then the corresponding map alpha, then this should be compatible, chi2. Okay, so instead of saying all this, could also phrase it in terms of category theory. So if you are into category theory, then probably that would be easier. So I can define a category of spacetimes by taking all these globally hyperbolic spacetimes as objects and these embeddings as morphisms. So this defines a category lock. And now this statement is just saying that a locally covariant quantum field theory is a functor. So A is a functor from lock to algebras. And well, depending on your taste, this could be, for example, star algebras for quantum theory, Poisson algebras for classical. So whatever you really want as your model. Okay, so this was very general. Now let's get to something more concrete. It turns out that this very general framework, yes?
Is it necessary that the Lie manifold be continuous? could you, for example,
have
an algebraic quantum field theory on a causal set, which just had a discrete set of points.
Yeah, you can. I think. I mean, there was a attempt to do that. So, yeah, I mean, you can. Up to this point, you can do that. It just changes your category lock somehow. Yeah, you could do that in the causal set. You just need the causal structure, really. Okay. Right. So maybe one more thing. So in the title, there was something about locally covariant quantum fields. So locally covariant quantum fields are somehow labels I put on observables so that I can have a physical interpretation for what I'm actually doing. So I want to be able to say what's the energy, what's the stress energy tensor, what's momentum of a particle. I want to be able to identify various physical quantities in different spacetimes. So if I was stuck in Minkowski, I can always use translation invariance to say, okay, I measure energy here, and I know exactly what does it mean to measure energy elsewhere. But if I'm on general spacetimes without symmetries, I have to put this as an extra structure. So I have to say from the beginning which observables have given labels. So this is done by locally covariant quantum fields. So locally covariant quantum field. So this is some sort of generalization of Whiteman fields. If you know Whiteman fields, then this should look familiar. So this is a family of maps labeled by spacetimes. So I have, for each spacetime, I have a map phi m, which goes from test functions to my observables. So this is the space of compactly supported functions on m. Okay, and this has to satisfy a covariance condition. So it has to transform nicely when I embed spacetimes into each other. So such that if I have chi going from m to n, so if I have now a field phi m at f, no, let's do it the other way. So I have f, which lives in the spacetime n. No, sorry. Okay. So it's a matter of rearranging this. So f lives here. So phi of f, I can now push it forward. So I can have a map where I push forward the test function, but I can also push forward the whole field using that map alpha. So here I have alpha chi should be the same as phi n, this time evaluated on the push forward of f. Okay, so at the moment, maybe this is not exactly clear what it does, but it's just a compatibility condition saying that there are two ways of getting something in a larger spacetime. One is to push forward the test function, the other is to apply these algebra maps, they have to be compatible. And what comes out is that fields we know from physics, from everyday experience, let's say like the stress energy tensor, local energy density, all what we call local observables actually satisfy this covariant condition. So everything we can construct locally from the local data fits the bill. Okay, so that is a locally covariant quantum field. And now I can move to the main topic, which is how to apply all this business to perturbative quantum gravity. But maybe first, why to apply all this business to perturbative quantum gravity? So our main motivation was to look at the situation where the effects of quantum gravity are not terribly strong, so that we can still stay in the regime where this metric perturbation is treated just as a quantum field on a fixed background. Now, one of the things we wanted to apply it to, and we are in the process of doing that, is cosmological perturbations. So understanding better what was happening in the early universe. Okay. Just make some more space in advance. So the next step is constructing models. So this is three, constructing. Oops, I think I destroyed this chalk. Constructing effective quantum gravity. So we start with fixing a background. So we will consider, well, now I will write more explicitly. So M spacetime is a manifold with a metric. So on the fixed background metric, we can now consider perturbations. So metric perturbation so we will have H, which is sections of cotangent bundle second symmetric power, so they're symmetric covariant tensors. So these are the metric perturbations, and I will denote this space by E. So the full metric is now G is equal G0, which is the background I fixed before, plus lambda H. And lambda is some sort of formal parameter. So I will look at everything as formal power series in lambda. So lambda is a formal parameter. All right. So this is my space of configurations. So my configurations are perturbations of the metric. And now I want to look at functions of that. So this will eventually lead to the notion of observables. So functionals on the configuration space. The first natural thing to do would be, let's try local functionals. Okay, local functionals are quite a good start. So let's take local functionals. So these are obviously functionals on E, and they depend on the field configuration only via the finite jet. So local functionals of the form f of h is an integral over the whole space of some function on the jet bundle. So this is a density on M. And for a given configuration, this depends only on the finite jet. So for given H, K is finite. Right, so these are local functionals, yeah? Oh, well, it's like Taylor expansion at the point. So you take the value of the function and the values of its derivatives. So that's essentially it. And you can do it in a bit more abstract way. But I mean, in short, it means that it depends on the value of the field and its derivatives at the point. All right, so I can also take products of this. So I define F is the space of sums of products of local functionals. Okay, so I call it multilocal. Now, the question is it meaningful to use such objects in effective quantum gravity, even effective one? Well, okay, what we want from our observables in quantum gravity is that they are invariant under diffeomorphisms, because the theory is invariant under diffeomorphisms. So even if we drop that a bit, so we say that we are working perturbatively, so it has to be invariant only under infinitesimal diffeomorphisms, it's still a lot. And in fact, local functionals is not enough to get something sensible which is invariant. So let me now come to this. So this was the most, let's say, problematic issue to solve in this framework, was to find, yes?
Right, I mean,
linearized, I'm looking at the full theory.
Okay, but
yeah, so linearized, yes, but I'm interested now, full equations of motion, full gauge symmetry, so yeah, I have to look at things which are invariant under the full transformation. Okay. Sorry?
I would rather expect that it's not possible to have fully diffeomorphisms.
Well, I mean, okay, let's see. Yeah, okay. I will show you what we are using, and let's compare that. So, yeah, I mean, full diffeomorphism in the sense of like non-infinitesimal, you mean? Or?
Non-linear order.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, let's see.
Yeah. Try to construct things, and if you try to extend certain observables which I use in cosmological perturbations theory, longitudinal gauge, you can use the longitudinal gauge and construct gauge invariant extension. And to nonlinear order, you get operators which are like inverse of Laplacian.
Okay, this is now classical. This is now classical first.
This is also.
Okay. Well, let's see how it compares. It must be using some different assumptions then.
Yeah,
okay.
Okay. I can also physically explain.
Yeah. Good. I will explain you what I want, and you will explain me why it's wrong. Yes.
But before we go to Conger,
I
have a suspicion that the way you set up the whole structure is cleverly organized to avoid two basic questions. So let me ask you the two basic questions.
Okay. Right.
One of them is that if we have fields defined at points, the products of them are not defined.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is that if I'm on a general curve space time without killing fields, the states are not well defined.
Okay, good. So first question is a randomization issue. So I will address the first question later on if I get time. Now, the second question, construction of states, well, this I don't know. I mean, I know it works with matter. If you have matter content, it works. I'm not sure if it works for pure gravity.
Well, my issue is a naive issue, so it's an issue with matter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I have a quantum field theory defined on a manifold.
Yeah.
Generally, to define the Hilbert space, I need to know who are positive frequency operators.
Right. So you're absolutely right. So what we are doing, we are using the Hadamard states. Okay. So we construct states which has a singularity structure, which is similar to the singularity structure of the Minkowski vacuum.
Good. No, I'm happy to hear that. But how do you say that?
So I can, okay, I can say that in my language. So we use a notion of a wavefront set, which sort of characterizes the singularity structure, and we require that this is contained in the forward light cone. So we choose somehow the, so we can formulate the positive frequency condition locally in terms of the wavefront sets. So, I mean, I think it translates. Sorry? We can talk about it later. Okay, so let me just give you an example of what I will mean as an observable here. So let's first take one of these guys. So let's take a locally covariant quantum field. So take, for example, phi m g0 of f of h as, well, the honest scalar curvature, which we know of the full metric, integrated with the test function, integrated with the volume form. Okay, I would probably drop this lambda at some point because I tend to forget it. Okay, so this is clearly not invariant under diffeomorphisms because, well, the support of this function is not invariant under diffeomorphisms. So let's take an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. So a vector field on M, and well, we know that it acts by the Lie derivative on configurations. So if I just act by Lie derivative on a functional, then I don't get anything invariant because the support would have to move. All right, so I can write down the general formula for f, a local functional, rho psi of f of h would be, well, let's write it like this. So df over dh in the direction of the Lie derivative of h. Okay, so this is how the functionals transform. Right, now let's try to fix this guy so it becomes invariant. Now, what stands in the way is this test function, because somehow we put there an object which is not a piece of geometrical data. So in order to fix our theory, we have to find an intrinsic way to specify that. So specify intrinsically. How do we do that? Well, first I will use some coordinate system which I define using the content of the theory. So if we are working with pure gravity, I will assume that we are on a non-generic background. So let mg0 be non-generic. Okay, and I define now four curvature scalars which will make my coordinate system. So define x mu g0 plus h, which I will write just x mu g, for mu equals 0 to 3. These are four scalars constructed locally covariantly from the metric. Four scalars constructed locally covariantly from the metric. And now another assumption, that at the lowest order, they define an honest coordinate system, and that, okay, so, well, I don't have to worry about higher orders because then it's perturbative anyway. So this defines an honest coordinate system. Okay. Right, another piece of data I need, I fix a function which I denote by bold f, is a function from R4 to R, and I now, okay, so these four coordinates, they map from the manifold M to R4. So let's write x, g, if I take all four of them, is in fact a map from M to R4. So I can now compose this map with, my function f, and obtain a function from the manifold to the real numbers.
Both,
right? So this is xg, but x of g0 is also a map from m to R4. They just differ by, so m, which is not the curly m, is just the space, just the manifold. And I can put g0 as a metric there, or g, right? No. It's not generic. Here it's non-generic, no symmetries here. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Oh my God, yes. Generic. Yes, thank you. Exactly the opposite of what I wanted. Yes, so G0 is generic. Because if it's non-generic, then things go wrong. Thank you so much. Sorry? Physical call. If I have matter fields in my theory, then I can use the matter fields, for example.
We agree that these are different
models. Yes. Yeah.
There's another problem.
Okay. Let's see if we find it.
There's another problem with these kind of observers.
Okay. Maybe I just finish first. Can I finish first? Okay. So I use this coordinate system to define function f as the bold f composed with xg. Oh dear, that sounds serious. Special effects, very good. And now I can use, so this is now a test function which is constructed intrinsically. So it depends on the geometrical data. Now I also have to assume that if I look at the lowest order, so if I look at the xg0, then this is compactly supported. Okay, so the final, yeah?
But it's not anymore really local.
No, it's not local, of course. I mean, it cannot be.
Why do you assume it to be a test function?
No, I mean, it has to be, yeah.
Test functions to localize.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I need that, yeah. I need that to make that integral sensible. I mean, so I need to have some weak notion of locality because for renormalization, I can work only with local quantities. So if I construct things this way, then the Taylor expansion around G0 with respect to lambda will have local coefficients. So this is what I need, yes.
Maybe this is just the thing where people was going to say. The worry about these kind of observables is that if you try to, G0 is generic.
Yeah.
So if you try to compute the Poisson algebra, let alone the quantum algebra of these observables, it's basically impossible.
Okay. If you want to compute something, yes. Yes, I'm a mathematician. No, but you see, I mean, this is why we looked at models with matter, So if you have coupling to matter, then you have more freedom for choosing these coordinates. So I can then choose these coordinates to be, let's say, a scalar field, which I have in the theory.
So your attitude as a mathematician.
Yes.
Is you may not be able to define the first product or commutator of any of these objects, but if you don't care.
No, I can define the commutator of these objects. I can definitely define the commutator of these objects.
You and I use the parameters. I slightly
disagree with Lee. One can actually compute the commutators in this case, and that has been done.
Okay.
For a generic metric, we have an example.
I mean, for an example where in certain limits, we have done it in Maroc before, but the problem is what you get for the two-point function.
Yes.
Is that if you use relativistic fields, I have to say, so you can avoid it if you use something unnatural, like dust field. But if you use the relativistic fields and ask, if I take my real interest, if I use four meta fields as my coordinates, then for the two-point function of another field, you will get the usual two-point function, but divided by something like the energy of your coordinate fields.
I think it's a bit far from what. I mean, I think what I'm doing is a bit far from what you are doing, because I work perturbatively, so I do not see this kind of global effect. I mean, so what I start with is the linearized gravity, and for the linearized gravity, I know my propagators, I know my two-point function, and then everything else uses that data, and it's just formal power series in lambda. So I don't see what can be not well defined there.
I guess it's that you use probably that already your background has very similar, that you have linear growing scalar fields in your background or something.
So let's look at the model. Okay, so let's look at something.
Background energy of your scalar
field. Yeah, let's look at something concrete. So. Yeah, I know, but every theorem has assumptions, so it might be that we are working on a different assumption, or in a different regime, in a different physical limit. So if I have, let's say, the Einstein-Hilbert-Lagrangian, so that plus the scalar field. So, whoops. Okay, plus m squared, phi squared. Okay, and this is, let's say, minimally coupled. Right. That's too much. Okay, so here I have my fields are phi and h, the perturbation of the metric. So in the linearized system, so I write it as L0 plus L interacting. So in the linearized system, I will have the, in the first instance, I will have this scalar field on the background. So this is the linearized theory. So it's essentially the scalar field and the linearized gravity. Okay, so I can now write down the field equations.
I guess your background is not that psi is equal to zero, but that psi is proportional to the coordinates.
Psi is proportional. So, right, so let's write it like this. So this is phi zero plus phi, yes, and g is equal to g zero plus h.
And psi zero needs to be guess now is
it needs to be a solution. It needs to be solution to, to the full Einstein's equations coupled to the scalar field on the background. So the background, this background, yes, this background is a solution to the field equations. Well, not anymore. I mean, if I'm looking at the matter, I do not require G0 to be generic anymore. The reason I required G0 to be generic is that I wanted these coordinate fields to be non-singular. In a situation where I have matter, I don't have to be that picky. I can take, let's say, 4 scalar fields or 4 dust fields or 4 whatevers, and then use them as coordinates, and then the background is what's the background for these fields. I mean, this is what Einstein equations tells us.
The background scalar fields, you want to be non-degenerate. I mean, basically, you want a P5. I mean, you can get 4 scalar fields at least. And
yeah.
The derivatives of this to be non. And then you say, okay, you consider an abstract solution, and I think in practice, for everything in practice, it will be very hard to find the solution.
Okay.
So you know, you don't have this problem because the problem is that the two-point function comes with the energy of the.
No, I don't agree with you. I don't agree with you because we use the two-point function. We use the two-point function for the linearized system. Okay, the two-point function for the linearized system is constructed from this data. There is no problem with the two-point function. These are free fields.
For phi, does it know the value of phi 0 as the solution?
Well, I mean, it does, because I'm linearizing around phi 0. So there might be, I mean, there will be, okay, well.
I'm speaking of the two-point function expressed in these physical coordinates.
But what do you mean by two-point function? Two-point function of what? So what I take the linearized system.
Yeah.
I take a Hadamard state for the linearized system, and first I can compute the correlation function, well, to the lowest order, is just a correlation function for the linearized free theory. Okay? And there is no problem with that. There is absolutely no problem with that. And then the higher orders, I get by taking higher corrections in lambda. So I think maybe one of the questions is that what you're up to, you want to have a full theory which is finite up to any order in lambda. And I'm not claiming this is finite limit in lambda, because this is not. Yeah.
It just says, I mean, I'm saying that in the two-point function, okay, you get it for the linearization of your field.
Yeah.
And the first term will involve something like the energy of your background fields, but inverted.
No, I don't agree with that.
Okay, I can.
I don't have energy of my fields inverted in my formulas.
It's a physical effect.
Yes, it's a physical effect. Okay.
Consider the two-point function tells you something how to resolve two space-time points. Now you measure your distances and so on with your background fields. Again, this approximation that you consider as a linearization. And it just tells you, if you want to know something about very two points which are very near to each other, you need very high accuracy and to put lots of energy into your background fields, which are supposed to be good plots.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very generic.
Mm-hmm. No, I think we are talking about different things, really, because I agree there might be some problem in taking the limits which you want, but these are not the problems on the level of, let's say, formal power series in the approach we are using. So I don't think, so okay, if you want to take this limit of the points getting very close, I agree that wouldn't make sense, but that wouldn't make sense also for ordinary fields, because the two-point function is a distribution. So if you take the limit of x and y coinciding, it diverges anyway. So I'm not sure if I understand what you want to do with that sort of limit. I mean, these limits do not exist usually anyway.
Yeah, no, it kind of diverges earlier in gravity because there's a question that you have to put a certain energy to resolve very small things, but then at some point you expect that the electron will form.
Mm-hmm.
Which you won't see in the linearized
series. Yes, because this is,
which say that there might be a fundamental non-locality.
Yeah, but before you reach that regime where things break down, this validity of this approach breaks down as well, because it makes sense only if the perturbation theory in lambda makes sense. And the effects you're talking about are way beyond what this approach is made for. So this is made for, let's say, like poor man's quantum gravity, when you're very close to the classical situation and the quantum effects are not really very seriously disturbing your vision. Now, if you look at the situation you described, then this doesn't apply. Hmm?
Maybe we should
yeah.
put it to the
yeah.
Is there something you can that cannot be computed via
the standard? Well, so what we are computing at the moment is we are looking at the cosmology applications. So we are looking at, let's say, higher order corrections to, various observables which are used in cosmology. So for example, there is the Mukhanov-Sasaki variable, which is standard in linearized theory in the linearized order, and we can compute higher order corrections to that coming from taking higher orders in lambda. So, okay, well, we can also...
Are these quantities that have quantum field theory divergences that you would have to worry about?
No, because we renormalized them. So,
but you're working with a theory that in perturbation theory has no renormalization scheme.
Right. So the renormalization scheme I am using, maybe they should also write. So maybe I just should list the things I'm using on the technical side. So. Well, first, for the free theory, I use the deformation quantization. Yeah, so for the linearized theory. All right, and now, from that, I introduce interaction using the Epstein-Glaser randomization. I don't know if this is known. So Epstein-Glaser randomization. And this works in position space. So this can be defined on curve space them as well. So this, okay. And the other advantage of that is it works on effective theories without the need for re-summing the series. So for effective theories. Yeah, because it works in each order of the coupling constant and each order of h bar. So you can compute the contributions at each order, but you don't ask for taking the sum over all orders in lambda. So, yes. Yeah? Sorry, I didn't understand.
So in the scheme, so what sort of regulator are you using?
I'm not using a regulator. So this in this approach, you don't go through a normal, you don't go through regularization. You define things, let's say directly, using, well, okay, on the technical side, it's using extensions of distributions. So it works locally. So I just need to look at the local singularity structure, and they can define things in that scheme. So as far as this goes, I mean, this doesn't really see a difference between an effective theory and, let's say, renormalizable theory. So you can renormalize non-renormalizable theories in that framework. Okay, right, so there is also the third bit. So for gauge fixing, I use the BV quantization. Okay, so this is probably for another talk. Okay, I think I'm done. I mean, I can finish now because I think I gave an overview of the main approach. And since we have a discussion, we can continue the discussion.
So maybe to ask if you're applying that to...
Oh, there's that.
If you're applying it to cosmology,
yeah,
which usually one understands is by definition homogeneous, but then you want to have some non-generic, I mean, somewhere you want to take your coordinate system.
Mm-hmm.
So
well, I mean, okay, so it gets a bit complicated. So we have some computations at the moment. Well, one thing we have, of course, is the scalar field, right? Because in cosmology, you always look at the scalar field coupled to the metric. So that scalar field can be used as the time coordinate.
So it's more the question.
Yeah, so for the spatial coordinates, you can do various things. So you can construct there are standard things in cosmology. You can have this non-local Bardeen potential, so you can use these as your coordinates. You can use...
Non-local,
I think it's called Bardeen potentials, from what I know. So these are constructed from metric perturbations.
So this is what I mentioned before, that typically these are gauges which are very non-local.
And okay, yeah, but,
extend,
yeah, yeah,
you can
sure.
Extend these to observers, which are just more familiar.
Yeah.
But they would include inverse of Laplacian operators.
Okay, but... I mean, these objects I'm asking for here are also non-local. So being non-local is not an issue. So on the technical side, you have to be a bit careful with renormalization if you get non-local quantities, because then at least, I mean, you have to check that things converge. But
No,
none of it. I mean, from this point, this all leaves that realm. So local is not enough, multi-local is not enough. You have to go beyond that. And then what do you take is up to you and your model, I think. But yeah, I agree that local doesn't work. Yes. Yes.
These conditions of these equations known as the squeezed limit consistency conditions, where at the cubic order you have basically considered three-point functions, and you have this limit that we were talking about earlier, where you can prove them to be really close in some sense, and there's a way in which these things stay together for the scalar and the graviton, so on and so forth. Is this, I mean, that's not an issue, right? You can still recover things like that.
What do you mean recover? I mean, can I, you're asking me if this limit exists or?
Yeah, so can I, do, there's a squeeze, do these squeezed consistency conditions in any sense?
Okay, I don't know because I haven't checked that, but this seems like something that can be checked. So yeah, you can definitely compute the three-point function. So what we are looking at is a bit beyond the standard cosmological perturbation theory because it also has corrections due to the interaction. So it's not just the linearized order. So there might be corrections to what you're talking about coming from randomization. But I'm not sure because I haven't looked at that particular thing.
Right. I mean, this is not linear, at least with the scalar is concerned, the scalar part of the metric perturbation is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, and also to the grand point, but only cubic.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay.
And, yeah, because there's a lot of talk, at least, that in the inflation and other such communities that, you know, if your morphism invariance, for instance, puts an infinite number of consistency conditions on such.
Okay, I can look into that, yes. Okay, thank you. Yes?
I have more of a conceptual
question. Yes.
So when on this panel, I think you defined, so it is not a race.
Oh, you, you remember,
when
good.
You defined a covariant from
yes,
theory,
yeah.
So that was some phi.
Yes.
Smears over test function.
Yes, yes.
With curly M,
yeah.
Which
mm-hmm.
is the amount.
Yes, the space-time,
so
yes.
So if I now think of this as an operator acting on a Hilbert space,
you want a representation.
Would that be also indexed with
mm-hmm. So, okay.
And would you then
yeah.
have an infinite power of Hilbert spaces, one for each?
So what you're talking about is states.
Sure.
So, okay, now I will use a bit of language. So algebras... form something like a pre-Cauchy, and the state spaces would form then a sheaf. So they go into the other direction. So yes, I mean, okay, if you want to look at the concrete space-time, yes, then you just choose your M, and then you choose your operator and choose a state from that state space.
But this must be programmed, so you're not supposed to.
Well, no, I mean, I have, I look at the perturbation around a background.
Right.
So I can do it around any background, but if I want to compute something around, let's say, okay, for cosmology, I would look at Friedman-Robertson-Walker background.
Okay, but just parenthesis.
Yeah.
Do you assert that if you chose background G0 and I chose a different background, G1,
yeah,
and we each computed some physical quantity to all orders in lambda, we would agree?
Very good. So if your background is not too far from mine, then yes. So if I look
What's
at...
Too
sorry?
Far? What's the meaning of not too far?
Not too far. So there is... Okay, I can give it a meaning in terms of some topology. But essentially, okay, I fix the background, and they look at small perturbation of the background. So G0 plus delta G, okay? So if I look at the small perturbation of the background, then let's say the gauge invariant quantities interacting full and so on, they are not affected by that change. So the theory is at least in the small neighborhood of a fixed background is invariant.
Right, okay, so that's as good as...
Yeah, yeah.
So now address this question.
Yeah. So, okay. yes. All right. So, in principle, okay, the theory is defined on all the Grabary hyperbolic background. But for practical computation, I need to choose something. I need to choose a state. I need to choose the space-time I'm interested in. So states exist in all the backgrounds, but if I want to have something concrete, then I want something more than just the statement that they exist. So I'm not sure what you want from this Hilbert space representation. I mean, if you...
What I'm more asking is if there's one Hilbert space for the entire theory or one for each one.
Well, it's not a Hilbert space. It's a space of states, right? I mean, a Hilbert space is something which I get from a state, but I can get the whole family of states. I mean, there is no fixing a Hilbert space. So, okay, we have quantum mechanics, right? In quantum mechanics, there's just one Hilbert space. In quantum field theory, there are many inequivalent representations. Inequivalent representations correspond to having many states on a given observable algebra. So fixing a state fixes me a Hilbert space representation. So even for a single theory on a single spacetime, even a single theory on Minkowski spacetime, okay, I still have plenty of states. I have the vacuum state, I have the thermal states, I have some bounded states maybe. So I'm happy to use all states. Don't want to restrict that. So what's assigned, let's say functorially, is a state space. So I have a space of states on a given space there.
So where does it go? Are you asserting or are you not asserting that you can do things that we believed you couldn't do in quantum field theory for many years?
Well, I think you could always do it in quantum field theory, you just never tried.
No, let me break it down, because there's two issues. There are observable diffeomorphism kind of issues, and there are perturbation theory and normalizable kind of issues.
Yeah.
So it's take 5 to the 8th scalar field theory in four dimensions. Do you claim you know how to define
it? Well, let's put it like this. So the Epstein-Glaser randomization is known since the 70s, okay? So this is nothing new. No, but okay, well, in the sense we are not really reinventing quantum field theory.
But is the claim of Epstein-Glaser randomization that you can give a well-defined meaning to the endpoint functions to all orders for 5 to the 8?
Well, it depends. It depends. What do you mean to all orders? I mean, if you want to, so.
Past 0th order.
No, but do you want to show the convergence of a series, or sum up the series, or you just
I don't care about the convergence.
Mm.
Okay. Want to go to any order I please.
Okay, so then one can compute the quantum corrections in each order, in h bar, and the coupling constant.
And what is some person, Mr. Epstein or Ms. Epstein-Glaser, say to the people using conventional renormalization, regularizations, who claim that those quantities are physically ambiguous?
Okay.
What choices were made to resolve the ambiguity?
Yeah, so... Well, if you ambiguous, of course, there is the randomization group action, okay? So there is ambiguities. There is always ambiguities. This is not giving a unique answer to the problem. So it's okay. What Epstein-Glaser did was an existence proof. So maybe that's why it wasn't so popular among the physics community, because it was very abstract. Nowadays, I think there are more computational methods, so we can actually construct things using that framework.
If I take QED, I know how to measure many different physical quantities in QED, and I know how to compute them to any order, any squared I want to, and we normalize and account with finite predictions for observable measurements that are really done. Supposing that I were in 6 dimensions of space, so that QED is perturbatively not renormalizable, I believe that I could not tell the experimentalists what they would find.
Well, of course, because there is the question, okay, so this framework gives you, this is maths, right? This gives you a certain mathematical answer to the mathematically posed question. Now, if I want to go to an experimentalist and try to show them the result, I would have to first check if that theory is a good approximation to what they measure in the experiment. So if I see that, okay, for the energy they are measuring and for other things this doesn't make sense, then that doesn't make sense, right?
The question is, like, what's the analog of, say, like, relevant or irrelevant deformations or...
Well, you look at, so you look at the behavior, okay. If you get the quantum corrections, which are larger than what you're correcting at the energy scale which you're looking at, then there's something wrong. So I think you have to see if this is a good approximation. I mean, it's a perturbation theory, right?
Is the claim that things that are ambiguous in conventional regularization schemes have definite mathematical answers to each order in lambda in the Epstein grade?
No, there is a randomization freedom. There is a randomization freedom.
Is there an infinite amount of randomization freedom in the theory that's called?
I know what you mean. Okay.
So what was the...
Yeah. So if you... Okay. Right. You're right. If I look at all the orders, then yes. In infinite, okay, so in the non-renormalizable theory, I can potentially get infinitely many parameters if I go to all orders.
Okay, so that's...
Good. Sorry, I just didn't catch what you're asking, yes. But if I look at the fixed order, then I get finitely many parameters. So if I have a good indication that I just want to, you know, cut the series at the fixed order, then I can... calculate something and compare it with experiment. I mean, usually, okay, in cosmological perturbation theory, people look at just the first order, right? So, and still there is some sort of physical information in that. Okay. Shall we finish?
Yeah, maybe.
Or maybe you have one more question. Yeah.
Which is that you started this locally, right, locally quantitative theory, which basically depends a lot about this notion of locality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also why I was basically a bit insisting on these points. But in the end, you use completely non-local observations.
Yeah, because of what they said on that panel on locally covariant quantum fields.
How much do you use also this original framework? Is it that you can still apply these technical things and not this embedding of observable algebras? These observables which you use in the case of cosmology, we think that they're totally non-local. At least in this cosmological context?
Yeah.
I mean, in most cases, we could say it's either use these scalar fields, but in some sense, they're completely non-local, or you use these cosmological kind of
perturbations,
stage fixings, which also involve the envelope of the charge. What do we use this kind of longitudinal relation, this part of So these are completely non-local because you ask a very non-local question, typically in cosmology. It's like in sheet dynamics, you know, what happens on upper surfaces which have everywhere
No, I think there are two questions here. So one question is of defining the locally covariant quantum fields, which uses that, let's say, local framework. But then the second question is specifying coordinates. And specifying coordinates is a potentially non-local problem, because it depends on, what you have available. So, choosing locally covariant quantum fields as your observables puts some constraints on, what's available. So, for example, for this transformation law, right, you want this bit here to be transforming locally, covariantly, and depend locally on the metric. So this part, right? So this part is a local field. The test function depends on non-locally constructed coordinates. So we start with a framework which is which has some local features, but we have to generalize it. We have to drop some of these in order to accommodate for, well, quantum gravity. I mean, it's known that you cannot work with just local objects.
Yeah, just, I want to get a taste for how much you have to drop.
Hmm?
I want to know how much you have to drop. Understand that you can take these actions and you can expand it, and mm-hmm. then you can use these technical tools on the right-hand side
mm-hmm.
To compute things.
Mm-hmm.
I do agree. I don't see how much it has to do with the original framework of local Cohen.
Well, yes. Well,
for me, if you do quantum theory in a certain way.
Okay, on the technical side, it does, because we are using essentially the same tools. On the conceptual, you have to make that step. I mean, you have to drop the locality. We are trying to argue that you don't drop this locality too much. I mean, you're weakening, your requirements on the observables, but you're still close to. I think the best you can get here, if I could choose these coordinates as local functions of the matter fields and the metric, that this would be great, and then that I think that would be the best we can hope for. The best we can hope for is that this is local and...
I do agree. And for these, you can actually also prove a kind of causality commutation relation.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas actually for the left-hand side, if you have this inverse Laplace operator, so I'm not sure that we can actually kind of prove a causality thing.
Mm.
Which would be already interesting to do.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you have...
On the right-hand side, it's quite easy to do for a locality thing, but then you get this effect with the point.
No, I think you have the causality for the linearized theory. Mm-hmm. For the linearized theory. But then you will have corrections to causality, right? So you have some...
So they computed these explicitly, and for the linear theory, they look exactly like...
Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. And to higher order, you get actually...
There would be some corrections, yes.
To higher order, the first time you get these inverse Laplace operators mm-hmm. appearing, and then it's hard to see anything about the causality of something.
Yeah, no, there is a... Yeah, of course, there has to be breaking of causality. Yeah, but the point is that we are staying close to the free theory.
Mm-hmm.
So we can refer to the causal structure of the free theory. And then see how much is it broken when we introduce the perturbation.
Thank you.